On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's been 70 years ago this coming Wednesday, 70 years ago that Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese Empire. To talk to us today about his brand new book, Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941, from DeCappa Press, which is a part of the Perseus Book Group, is Stan Weintraub. Stan is a National Book Award finalist, Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University, and the award-winning author of more than 50 highly acclaimed books, including Silent Night and 11 Days in December. It's our great pleasure to welcome Stan Weintraub to talk to us today as we observe the 70th anniversary and think how very different things were back all those decades ago. It's good to have you on the bookshelf today.
Thank you. I was in eighth grade when the football game I was listening to on the radio was interrupted by news about Pearl Harbor. So I do remember it very well. I missed out on the war because I was a little too young, but Korean War caught up with me. I was an aspiring historian back in junior high school, and I began writing from radio or newspaper accounts what I thought would be a history of the war. But what was happening seemed too depressing in December 1941 to continue. Soon bubblegum cards, like baseball cards, began appearing about the war. I don't know if any of your old-timers remember them. They were poster-like, and despite everything going wrong, they were upbeat. And I began collecting them. Number one was General MacArthur. The caption on the other side of the card described him in heroic terms, and I found out later that nothing in the account was true except that his name was spelled right.
Right.
All the reverses worldwide in the bubblegum cards that followed were equally heroic and inspiring. Sometime during the new year, and that is in 42, because of the shortages of bubblegum that got to be reserved for the troops, the war cards stopped getting manufactured. But I still have over 200 of them.
Wow.
They were my substitute history.
See, my dad was about your age, and my dad talked about saving those bubblegum cards.
That's where my history began, bubblegum cards.
I got interested in history during the centennial of the Civil War when I was in third grade, I think, when that began, and they had bubblegum cards that were available then. Now, things were so different 70 years ago as far as the attitude of the American people to the monumental task before them.
But the American people were in shock. But they really didn't know much about what was going on. They didn't know the real facts about the destruction of Pearl Harbor. That was deliberately withheld because I think we would have had terrible defeatism around the country if the people had learned that eight battleships had been sunk and were at the bottom of the harbor, that other ships were damaged or sunk, that hundreds of airplanes had been destroyed on the ground. I'm not sure that we could have recovered easily if we had known how bad it was then.
That's one thing that with the instant communications we have now, there would have been no hiding any of the really bad news or any of these horrendous images that emerged later from the attacks and all of the civilians who were killed and all of the military personnel who were killed and those who died horribly in the ships scalded and burned with hot oil or trapped, like in the Arizona, forever entombed in their ships.
We had no idea that over 1,000 sailors had been entombed in the Arizona, which is still a memorial in Pearl Harbor. One can go out to the memorial on board a small boat and see what was left of the Arizona. The crow's nest mast is still there, for example, and the ship has never been raised, and it remains officially on duty as a member of the Navy. That the only such ship that remained active, although of course it's not, it's only a memorial.
When word first started getting out, people were listening on the radio, and the radio told everybody what was happening, what had just happened in Pearl Harbor. Was there on the radio a huge movement to have more and more news reports, or did it become the topic of discussion in every radio show? And war bonds came later, I know that.
Of course, it overwhelmed all broadcasts about everything, and that lasted for days. The big problem was that people didn't realize that the war was worldwide. Pearl Harbor was not the only place in the Pacific that was attacked. We knew there was a war going on in Europe that we had no role in yet, but we had no idea that Guam would be overwhelmed, that Wake Island would be invaded, that the Philippines would be bombed and invaded, and much of the aircraft again destroyed on the ground. This was a situation absolutely unknown to Americans before. We were still in a period of rather happy prosperity. Christmas was coming. The stores were full of toys and gifts, and there was no shortage of anything. Obviously, there was no food rationing yet. The first rationing came along right after Christmas. I think the government very carefully waited until after Christmas to announce the tires would be rationed and that the speed limit would be lowered to 35 miles an hour in order to conserve gasoline. That was the first news we had of tightening belts.
I was fascinated by the account of Christmas gifts that were still available in that Christmas 1941, which would not be available the next several Christmases to come. Nylon stockings being a buck 65, I think, and cars were $500, which...
The nylons were interesting because Winston Churchill decided to come over to this side of the water in order to talk with President Roosevelt about strategy, how to get out of the mess we were in and win the war. And one of the first things he did when he arrived was to get in touch with his wife Clementine in London and say, what size stockings do you need? There were nylon stockings available. And, of course, there were no such things in England, which was strictly rationed. And even the next year, there were no nylons in the U.S. because nylon was being saved for parachutes.
Right. Now, there's something else that when Churchill noticed, when he came, and I suppose we're getting ahead of ourselves just a tad, because one of the things that you talk about in Pearl Harbor Christmas is this amazing, unprecedented thing that the British Prime Minister sails across the North Atlantic, dodging the U-boats to get to Washington, D.C. to meet with the President Roosevelt. And when he gets to our shores, he's astonished to see lights everywhere, because back home, the lights have been out because of the bombings for over a year.
The Christmas lights were still on in the United States, and they were shocked not only by lights, but shocked by the vast amounts of food and drink and gifts and so on that were available, because we hadn't had any stringency about these things yet. We would, but not yet. And I think Churchill may have also been surprised when he arrived by plane at a naval air base near Washington from his battleship in Virginia, and was met by Roosevelt himself, although Roosevelt had been disabled by polio for many years, since 1921. But Roosevelt, with canes and braces, was leaning on his car to greet Churchill. And it was an armored car, but it was the first armored car a president had used. But it had belonged to Chicago gangster Al Capone and had been confiscated by the Treasury Department when he went to jail.
Amazing. There are just so many things in your book that are revelations to us, even though this has been 70 years and there's certainly been plenty of books written about Pearl Harbor and about America. But just the fact that talking about these days that took place at a time when America was astonished at what had happened. In case you're just joining us, folks, we're talking to Stan Weintraub, who is the author of Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. It's from DeCapo Press, which is a division of the Perseus Publishing Group. Stan is talking to us about what it was like for people in America to be stunned by the surprise attack, to not realize that the Japanese were simultaneously attacking all over the South Pacific, and what was practically the high water mark of the Japanese Empire was this first week or so of their successful assaults in Singapore and everywhere else, and eventually getting to the point of threatening Australia even with being the next place that they were going to invade.
Well, Australia was being threatened, but the area above Australia, the area we now know as Indonesia, then the Dutch East Indies, and Malaysia above it, and Singapore, were invaded very quickly by the Japanese, and there was no way that they could be defended. American ships that left the Philippines, because the Philippines was being overrun, left Manila Bay and went down to the Dutch Indies, and then had to flee from the Dutch Indies south to Darwin, Australia. The Japanese moved very quickly, and by the time Churchill arrived in Washington, the 22nd of December, 1941, the Japanese fleet was already reaching Hiroshima Bay, having returned from their attacks. They hadn't lost a ship. They lost very few planes because we had been asleep at Pearl Harbor. And soon the Japanese newspapers published pictures of the air raid showing the bombs dropping on Pearl Harbor. Of course, they thought the war was won.
And
it actually was lost at Pearl Harbor because there were no aircraft carriers to destroy. They were at sea. And this would be a war airplanes above the sea, not of ships on the sea. And the Japanese got none of our carriers. As a result, it was only 6 months later at the Battle of Midway that their fleet was nearly destroyed, and we began to turn things around.
Right. From that point forward, the Japanese fought a defensive war until August of 1945. But in December of 1941, it looked very rosy for the Japanese indeed, and very scary for the Allies. One of the things that you talk about in Pearl Harbor Christmas is the close relationship that Roosevelt and Churchill had previous to this time that they spent together. And it's really pretty amusing how Churchill gets to the White House and stays instead of just...
Yes, it was like the old comedy, The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Right.
He stayed, and he left twice during his long period, which was nearly 3 weeks at the White House. He left once to go to Canada to speak to the Canadian Parliament, and he went off in President Roosevelt's private railway train. And then he went off again briefly to Florida for a short holiday of a few days. People did not know, not even President Roosevelt knew, that in the White House, Churchill had had a heart attack and was recovering from a heart attack. Only his doctor knew. And his doctor realized that nothing could be done. Churchill smoked too much. He drank too much. All you could do would be to try to keep him going. And his doctor did. Churchill never announced that heart attack, never revealed it. Only after he died did his doctor reveal that he had had that heart attack in the White House.
Well, and it's also important for us to remember that Churchill was not a young man during World War II. He had been a war correspondent during the Boer War around the turn of the century. He'd been Lord of the Admiralty in World War I and had to step down in disgrace because of a miscalculation at Gallipoli. Churchill was a seasoned veteran of British politics and of wartime politics. And to me, he's really one of my biggest heroes, because it seemed to me that for a long time that he, by his determination, kept the nation of Great Britain unified against the Germans when it really looked much worse for them than it ever looked for us, even.
His feistiness was very important in keeping the British in the war. And what he constantly wrote to President Roosevelt asking for supplies, equipment, war material of all sorts, and he always signed his letters "former naval person," because that's what he was. As you said, he had been First Lord of the Admiralty. But he knew Roosevelt would appreciate that, because as a young man, Roosevelt was only 31 when this happened, he became Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson, and was Assistant Secretary of the Navy during all of World War I. So he had experience not quite at the level of Churchill's, but they had something in the way of rapport from that mutual experience.
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, Roosevelt, distant cousin, fourth cousin, I think, Theodore Roosevelt, had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy immediately prior to the Spanish-American War.
Yes, and he was, to Roosevelt, he was Uncle Ted. He really wasn't Roosevelt's uncle. He was Eleanor Roosevelt's uncle and was only a cousin to Franklin Roosevelt. But he was Uncle Ted, and Roosevelt, the younger Roosevelt, looked up to him very much. He was not quite a father figure, but he was a figure more ideal, somebody to aspire to.
Right. Theodore Roosevelt's a pretty big hero of mine, too. I think he was kind of larger than life, just like Churchill. And the relationship between FDR and Churchill prior to the outbreak of war, as Churchill tried to convince Roosevelt, you need to commit, you need to go ahead and get involved in the war, and Roosevelt holding back, saying there's too many really organized pacifists in America at this time. They're not going to want to go to war in Europe. And really, if we had not been attacked by the Japanese, if the war in Europe probably would have progressed to the point where we really couldn't have done much good unless we had had extraordinary loss of life.
Roosevelt was trying very hard to trap the Germans into attacking our ships in the Atlantic, because then he would have had an excuse to go to war against the Germans. But the Japan made it a lot easier by attacking Pearl Harbor. Then, in reciprocity with Japan, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. And he said, we can't possibly lose the war with Japan as our ally. Japan has never lost a war in 3,000 years.
You know, and that's true. They didn't even have a word for surrender until August 1945.
And Japan, of course, didn't want to surrender. They would have had a suicidal defense of their islands if the atom bomb hadn't come along and convinced them that they had to give in.
Right. I've read about the little clay pots that were made by the hundreds of thousands and were stored in caves in Japan in preparation for the eventual land invasion by the American troops. That were just large enough to hold a hand grenade. And the plan was a child would put a hand grenade in the little pot and run up and hug a GI who would automatically hug a child. And then the hand grenade would go off, killing the American as well as the child, of course. A very determined people.
I had written about World War II before and did write about the end of the war. I'm a proponent of having dropped the bomb. There are people who feel that this was morally repugnant, but you have to think of the millions, about probably a million men who had been killed and wounded invading Japan.
Right.
It didn't happen because of that.
I remember reading.
I was in Hiroshima. I did see the damage because I had been in the Korean War and went by way of Japan.
Right.
So I was able to see Japan not too long after the end of the war.
Wow. Now, I remember reading about 20 years ago in American Heritage magazine that they were just then using up the last of the Purple Hearts that they had made for the invasion of Japan. They had made, the United States military had made 1 million Purple Hearts in preparation for the land invasion of Japan, figuring that they would take that many casualties.
And so, this was a great shock to people when this was discovered. The Purple Hearts that were made for the landings in Japan were actually used right through the Vietnam War. They had to change the ribbons because the ribbons had gotten a bit shoddy.
Right.
But the Purple Hearts were still being used. The medals that were given out at Pearl Harbor were interesting too, because many of the medals, unfortunately, had to be posthumous.
Yeah.
So many men had died. And died under heroic circumstances. One of the strange things about Christmas Eve at Pearl Harbor was that we didn't know this until years later, but the Oklahoma, which had been capsized and sunk, had men trapped in it, and the markings on the bulkhead revealed that some of the 415 men sealed below had survived for 17 agonizing days until Christmas Eve. That was a terrible thing, and I didn't put that into Pearl Harbor Christmas because I worried that readers would be so appalled that they put the book down and never open it again.
Yeah, that's the destruction that was in Pearl Harbor. It's hard for us to imagine just what it was like and just how. What a really well-organized attack it was. It was very well planned, coordinated with all these other Japanese naval and air forces spread across the South Pacific, hitting all these different places simultaneously so that nobody could come to the aid of any of the others.
The whole idea of trying to destroy our fleet was so that we could not come to the aid of of the countries on the Pacific Rim that they were about to invade. And, of course, they did. And as I said, it was Christmas Eve when the end of the lives came for the men trapped in the Oklahoma. And it was Christmas Eve that was a high point for Americans who were listening to the radio and in Washington, D.C., because the national Christmas tree was lit. And Churchill and Roosevelt were both there to do it. And one thing that occurred there must have been a lot like what we have occurring now when we go to an airport. People were allowed by security to go onto the White House lawn to listen to the two men, the two leaders, and watch the Christmas tree being lit. But many of them came with armfuls of Christmas packages that they had just bought for the next day. And they weren't allowed to take them in. They had to leave them at the gate, the White House gates. And strangely enough, it was a different time. Nobody stole anything. They got their gift packages back again when they left.
Amazing. One of the points that you make, and I really enjoy the way that you walk us through the days, taking us from December the 7th all the way up through New Year's Day in the book Pearl Harbor Christmas. There's one thing that you're talking about when Churchill is having a press conference in Ottawa, and they ask him about Singapore. And you make the point that the British would surrender a garrison of 85,000 men to a lightly armed Japanese assault force of 30,000 on February the 15th of 42, the worst defeat under the Union Jack since Yorktown in 1781.
That was a terrible time for the British, but they were very badly led. The incompetence of the generals in Malaya and Singapore is unbelievable. But people got their jobs very often because they belonged to the right family.
Right.
And that it was not a merit system.
Well, one thing, I guess you might say, fortunate result of the initial invasions by the Japanese Empire is that there a lot of these officers were taken out of the situation. They were captured or they were killed, and we learned, and the British learned from the mistakes that were made, for the most part, except for MacArthur, who just seems to be a guy who is forever blowing his own horn. And this is not the only book that I've ever read that is critical of his leadership in the war, that he seemed to be better about writing press releases than about actually leading,
He actually wrote all of the communiques that came out from the Philippines, and they never referred to any individual soldiers or officers or places. They referred to MacArthur's men. Everybody involved were MacArthur's men. It was quite a PR job on his part. And strangely enough, he won the Congressional Medal of Honor, which was given to him because Roosevelt and his generals worried about our not having any heroes yet. Who could we hold up as a hero? And so they decided, let's give a Medal of Honor to General MacArthur. It's the only medal he doesn't have. But his father had earned one in the Civil War.
Right, right. Arthur MacArthur.
So he got a Medal of Honor.
Wow. And abandoned Vinegar Joe Stillwater and the nurses and everyone else to the Japanese when he managed to escape Philippines.
He was ordered to escape. We have to give him credit at least for having obeyed orders to leave and to go to Australia. We didn't want him captured because he would have been a great symbol for the Japanese if he had been captured in a prisoner of war. So we wanted him out of there. And it's interesting that he should have made the Bataan Peninsula, a great symbol for himself. He even named his airplane in Australia the Bataan. Mm-hmm. He was only on the Bataan Peninsula once for 1 hour, and that was it.
There's so much more information and fascinating stories and insights into the personalities of Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill and other great and not so great men of the day that are all in Pearl Harbor Christmas from DeCapo Books. And Stan, I've just found this enormously intriguing and learned an awful lot about what it was like for my parents to be children during this time. And so I really want to thank you, and particularly in light of the 70th anniversary of Pearl Harbor that's coming up later this week. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about or another story that you wanted to tell that I wasn't wise enough to ask about?
I think we left out all the little people. I talked about the big men, the big two mostly, but a lot of soldiers and sailors who were just ordinary people from all over the country have their stories told in the book, and I think that gives a human face to the war.
Right, because it wasn't just about the big famous people; it was more about the small town guys and gals and the people from the boroughs and the cities that came together and did these incredible things, and the folks back home who supported them and did whatever they had to do, paper drives and scrap metal drives and giving up stockings and giving up eggs and rubber and all the other things that the folks back home had to do to win.
Yes, it brought the country together. The country had not been unified because of there was so much pacifism, but Pearl Harbor...
Well, Stan, it's a terrific book, Pearl Harbor Christmas from DeCapo Press, which is a member of the Perseus Books Group. If you'd like to find out more about Stan's books, you can go to DeCapoPress.com. Stan, do you have a website yourself?
No, I don't, but people can find me easily enough online.
Okay.
There may be 50,000 or more hits.
And I hope you have a wonderful Christmas.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have shared memories with you.
Our thanks again to Stan Weintraub. That's Weintraub, the author of Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941, from DeCapo Press. We'll see you next time on The Bookshelf. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.